Hello.
And welcome again to another conservative historian podcast. This one entitled The Ghosts of World War One. The date is March 2024, and my name is A.D. Tippett. Before I get into the podcast, I just wanted to tell you to check out all of our other podcasts. There's over 200 of them covering all range of history. I also put a small essay out on my Substack site, so please check that out. And I am published in the Freeman newsletter as well. And now, on to the ghosts of World War One. The Great War differed from all ancient wars in the immense power of the combatants and their fearful agencies of destruction, and from all modern wars in the utter ruthlessness with which it was fought. Europe and large acts of Asia and Africa became one vast battlefield on which, after years of struggle, not armies, but nations broke and ran. Winston Churchill, writing in 1923. The First World War was at once piteous, in the poet's sense, and a pity. It was something worse than a tragedy, which is ultimately something we are taught by the theater to regard as unavoidable. It was nothing less than the greatest error of modern history. Niall Ferguson, The Pity of War, Explaining World War One. Now, about once every few years, I go back to World War One. I recently finished John Keegan's epic on this conflict, entitled The First World War. It is nearly impossible to capture the necessary details of a conflict involving so many nations in so many places. Keegan's book, published in 1999, is surprisingly short for a conflict of this magnitude, coming in at a relatively compact 400 pages. Of the British action on the Somme in 1916, involving hundreds of thousands experienced combat for the first time, Keegan writes that this battle resulted in the greatest loss of life in British military history. Together with the Third Battle of Ypres in July 1917, better known as the Battle of Passchendaele, from the name of the Belgian village where it took place, where 70,000 British soldiers were killed and 170,000 wounded. The Somme broke the back of the old British army and more besides. The Somme marked the end of an age of vital optimism in British life that has never been recovered. Of the French, who fought the Germans alongside the British on the Western Front, Keegan says this: the French, upon whose land it was fought and lost 1.7 million men in action, can only be imagined. In 1918, there were 630,000 war widows in France and many tens of thousands of single women who would never marry. They could still be seen as late as the 1960s, grown old, working at menial tasks in the public sector, clipping subway tickets or cleaning toilets. A gloomy reminder of the Great War, like the memorials to the dead on virtually every village square in the land. As for Germany, World War One sowed the seeds for the level of dissatisfaction that would lead to the rise of Nazism and World War II. The energy of Britain and France had been so diminished during World War One that there was little fortitude to summon in the late 1930s, when Hitler could have been stopped before rearming the nation. And as for the rest of Europe, after thousands of years of monarchical rule, several new forms of government emerged. The houses of Habsburg, Osman, and Romanov all fell after the war. Minor kings in Greece, Romania, and Serbia later followed. Some would be followed by military rule, such as in Turkey, or communist Bolshevik totalitarianism in Russia. In a review of the book for the New York Times by Tony Ute, entitled The End of World War, a military historian explains why World War One happened and how it changed everything, and provides a description of what this reviewer thought of Keegan himself. John Keegan is a military historian, perhaps the best military historian of our day, and his new war history exemplifies his many strengths. It is elegantly written clear, detailed, and omniscient. As a narrative, it is outstanding, telling the story of how the war began, was fought, and why the Allies won. Above all, Keegan conveys how it felt. To our eyes, World War I can seem mysterious. Why did such a pointless war occur? How could such useless carnage have lasted so long? Why did men continue to serve and fight in such unspeakable conditions? Keegan never plays down these concerns, but he addresses them in terms contemporaries would have understood. And yet Keegan, though an exceptional storyteller and historian, was not there. As a 15-year-old, I read B.H. Littlehart's A History of the First World War. I first started reading history in the 7th grade, but most of the books I had read contained second-party reporting of the events. Littlehart was not writing about the war through primary or secondary sources. He was providing a first-hand account. On the outbreak of World War I, in August 1914, Littlehart volunteered for the British Army, where he became an officer in the King's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry in December and served with the regiment on the Western Front. Littlehart's frontline experience, though, was relatively brief, confined to two short stints in the autumn and winter of 1915. He was sent home from the front after suffering concussive injuries from a shell burst. After promoted to captain, he returned to the front for a third time in 1916 to participate in the Battle of the Somme. He was wounded three times without serious injury before being badly gassed and sent out of the line in July 1916. His battalion, though, was nearly wiped out on the first day of the offensive on July 1st, a part of the 60,000 casualties suffered in the heaviest single day's loss in British history. And I would note the use of poisonous gas as a weapon. Other novel tools of this war in this conflict included machine guns, barbed wire, airplanes, and tanks. As I have noted, World War I began in August 1914 and did not end until 4 years later with the armistice that was signed in November of 1918. Now, the millions of casualties suffered on the Western Front occurred along lines initially drawn in 1914, and by March 1918 had barely budged. Defensive war technologies were so far ahead of offensive ones, despite all the best efforts of the combatants. One harrowing account of the Battle of Verdun noted that if all of the fallen had risen from the dead, there would be no place for the corpses to stand, so crowded would be the fields. And here are the brutal statistics. According to the Census Bureau, who accumulated these numbers, the total number of military and civilian casualties in World War I was around 40 million. There were 19 million deaths and 21 million wounded. The total number of deaths includes 9.7 million military personnel and about 9 million civilians. The Entente powers, also known as the Allies, this would primarily be Russia, Britain, France, and later the United States, lost about 5.7 million soldiers, while the Central Powers, again chiefly Germany, Austria-Hungary, Turkey, and Bulgaria, lost about 4 million. And not all of these were combat deaths. Military casual statistics listed here include combat-related deaths as well as military deaths caused by accidents, disease, and deaths while prisoners of war. Most of the casualties during World War I were actually due to war-related famine and disease. Civilian deaths due to the Spanish flu, however, have been excluded from these figures whenever possible. But I would note that would World War I not have happened, I'm not certain that the Spanish flu epidemic would have been nearly as virulent. Now, historians often cite these statistics, and I've already shared with you a number of them. But as Stalin correctly noted, a single death is a tragedy, a million deaths are a statistic, It's difficult to find a better example of this than World War I, yet each combatant was a single human being with the needs, wants, desires, and dreams we all hold dear. And here is an account written by British soldier Harry Wells, who during the war, strangely, meets his brother. Evidently, my brother had heard the reports of my premature death, for when he entered a trench at La Bassée one morning in November and saw me there, he came to me, shook hands warmly time after time, and almost cried with joy. "Thought you had gone under it," he said. "No, Robert," I said, "but I may tell you I have had some very narrow escapes." "Do you know, Harry," he said, "I can hardly believe my eyes when I look at you. It seems too good to be true." Dragoons officer Hubert Rushrow's name is commemorated on a war memorial in Bellebray, his native village in central France, along with those of other young men who lost their lives in the war. And remember, something that Keegan had noted, every single one of these villages has a World War I war memorial inscribed with the names of all of these young men who perished. However, Rochereau also has a much more poignant and exceptional memorial. His room in a large family house in the village has been preserved with his belongings for nearly 100 years since he died in Belgium. The young officer's parents kept his room exactly as it was the day he left for the battlefront. When they decided to move in 1935, they stipulated in the sale that Rochereau's room should not be changed for 500 years. "Now, this clause has no legal basis," said the current owner, retired local official Daniel Fabre, who showed the room to the Nouvelle République newspaper. But nevertheless, he and his wife, who inherited the house from her grandparents, have respected the wishes of Rochereau's parents and will continue to do so. Rochereau was 22 when he was killed. A few years ago, in 2022, we had a remake of a German novel. Paul Baumer is a fictional character and not a real person. However, his experiences are very realistic because they were based on the author Erich Maria Remarque and what he saw, felt, and did as a German soldier in World War I. All of those experiences that Remarque captured in his book, All Quiet on the Western Front, were taken from, again, like B.H. Littleheart, a first-hand account. Personally, stories of World War I affected me in a way that no other conflict had. The image of the lone British soldier traversing a barren landscape, clad in a gas mask so that you cannot see his face, is a haunting image. I have probably studied easily over 100 wars, from Qin Shi Huangdi's unification of China to the Ptolemies fighting Seleucids in the Levant, Altuapa defeating his brother Huascar in the Incan Civil War, to the Crimean conflict in the middle of the 19th century. The first history book I ever read was about the Battle of Iwo Jima, which led to a comprehensive study of World War II. And of all of these, World War II is arguably one of the few that we could call a good war, a justified war. There was the appalling nature of the Nazi regime, coupled with Japan's naked imperial ambitions. Both Germany and Japan's sense of racial superiority over their conquered, which led to so many horrific acts, made their destruction on the part of the Allies feel justified. However, there is no such moral aspect to World War I. There once was a time when American school books would talk of the rape of Belgium or the sinking of the Lusitania as examples of Germany's many atrocities. Sins that Blackjack Pershing and the American Expeditionary Force needed to avenge. The reality is a little different. Indeed, the Central Powers, led by Germany and including Austria-Hungary, Bulgaria, and Ottoman Turkey, all entered the war with imperial conquests on their minds. Yet France thirsted for revenge for a war that was 40 years in the past and the reclamation of two of their provinces. Britain did not appreciate Germany's naval buildup that challenged British supremacy on the seas, something the island nation had enjoyed for over 200 years. Russia craves sovereignty over the Balkans, direct access to the Mediterranean, and a nationalistic cause to buttress the tottering Romanov dynasty. Even Italy, joining the war in May 1915, coveted Austro-Hungarian possessions on her border. The minor players, from Bulgaria to Romania, all desired to add land. And of all the combatants, Serbia might be the one case where aggression was perpetrated upon them. Yet even here, the small nation's bellicose attitude towards Austria-Hungary, who had lost their imperial heir to an assassination from a Serbian national, was not without blemish. Whereas World War II began with Hitler's and the Soviet Union's invasion of Poland and Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor, the precipitating event of the First World War was that noted assassination of Franz Ferdinand, heir to the increasingly shaky Habsburg Empire. When the heir was killed, Austria-Hungary threatened Serbia, who in turn made some concessions that might have ended the conflict there and then. But World War I was a case where the confidence of the key players was so high that they could scarcely contemplate defeat. In the case of Austria-Hungary, fears of what a troublesome Slavic state like Serbia might instigate into the future also dictated their moves. In 1914, the Habsburg Empire was a polyglot mixture of Hungarians, Czechs, Poles, Romanians, Serbians, and Bosnians, and yet ruled over by Germans, who constituted less than 12% of the total population. A more vital state might have settled the assassination issue diplomatically. However, one of the lessons or ghosts of World War I is that weak nations, trying to appear strong, are often instigators of war. I would argue we see this today in Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And in World War I, Romanov Russia, Ottoman Turkey, Bulgaria, Italy, Romania, and the Habsburgs were all playing the game of war from a weak position. And even France, who less than 100 years earlier had conquered almost all of Europe, was in their slow decline from being once the leading power of Europe to one of second-class status. Indeed, only three powerful states were involved in the conflict. Those would be Britain, Germany, and later the United States. Clearly, if Britain or Germany faltered early in the conflict, the war would have ended for the others' benefit. Though historians love to cite the incident of Franz Ferdinand's murder, I feel more that it was kind of a pretext than the critical event. That really, that this was a powder keg waiting for any spark to ignite. Every political and military national leader believed that the war was to be quick. The Germans banking on their previous successes in the Franco-Prussian War, and the Allies' belief in their numerical superiority, referring to the Russian army as a steamroller. This was a major, major miscalculation. Others abound in the conflict, including the advancement of technology in determining how wars were fought, and the ability to properly manage the armies and the fleets participating in the war. The last great conflict fought on the continent of Europe was the Franco-Prussian War of 1870, which featured a Prussian-German northern states combined army of approximately 600,000 men facing a French army that was initially 250,000, but later grew to around 900,000. But it should be noted that these later additions were ill-trained and lacked any experience, however. Thus, with a superior army, superior generals, and a better plan, the Prussians won the Franco-Prussian War. In August of 1914, however, the Germans mobilized over 1.9 million soldiers, well over three times the size of that of which they had fielded just 40 years before, with the majority initially deployed against France. Yet the ability to coordinate a mass of men of this magnitude had not caught up to the size of the armies. In one battle, it was noted that a company attacking at the Battle of the Somme had to relay their progress and position back to the battalion command post, and thus through regimental, brigade, and division headquarters. Each of these messages had to be relayed individually up through the chain, and each of these messages could take hours and some never made it. That meant a general, even at the division, much less army level, would have very little sense of whether an attack was succeeding or failing, or whether to send in reinforcements or suspend the offensives. Often the result was, even when attacks were stalling, fresh troops were fed into battle, resulting in tens of thousands of needless deaths. And it was little better with the navies, with the fleets. Admiral John Jellicoe, commander-in-chief of Britain's Grand Fleet, flew his flag in the Iron Duke, a ship commissioned into the home fleet in March 1914 as the fleet flagship. She was armed with a main battery of 10 14-inch guns and was capable of a top speed of 22 knots. The Iron Duke could decimate any ship not built within 20 years and launch a shell at nearly 24,000 yards. And yet, the Grand Fleet still needed signal flags to coordinate movements. The Battle of Jutland, one of the few significant fleet actions of the war, could have been a resounding victory by the British, and yet it was not, because they had inadequate communication systems. One of the great military leaders of the 19th century, Helmuth von Moltke, who beat the Austrians in 1866 at the Battle of Königgrätz, and then the French in the Franco-Prussian War 4 years later, had great insight into what was to come. I should note he was referred to as the Elder to distinguish him from his nephew, who had none of his uncle's brilliance. Von Moltke said, "The days are gone by when, for dynastical ends, small armies of professional soldiers went to war to conquer a city or a province and then sought winter quarters or made peace. The wars of the present day call whole nations to arms. The entire financial resources of the state are appropriated to military purposes." Von Moltke would also have understood that armies of this magnitude would require an entirely different way to manage them. Conscripting and crafting armies of millions and then having them invade a nation's entire frontier is one thing. However, appropriately directing them was something else. Essentially, the generals of World War I never overcame this weakness. Technology outstripping the human capacity for control is not foreign to our 21st century mindsets. From social media to AI, we are now facing a domestic situation where we have no clue about how technology shapes our society, nor will we have any clue in a future war about what that technological advancement will mean, unfortunately, until the shooting starts. In one World War Sea battle, Admiral Christopher Craddock lived up to the British Royal Navy ethos of Horatio Nelson to always take the offensive. The problem with this ethos is that in reality, Craddock's fleet was outmatched by the Germans. Not only were his ships much older, but the Germans had superior range. In other words, German shells could reach the British fleet, but Craddock's fleet could not return fire, or at least anything in which a shell could even get close to the German ships. The result was the loss at the Battle of Coronel of much of Craddock's fleet and his own life. While the British lost 1,600 men, the Germans did not lose a single ship and had only a few men wounded. It was the first British naval defeat since the War of 1812. Admiral David Beatty wrote his wife, "He was a gallant fellow, and I am sure put up a gallant fight, but nowadays no amount of dash and gallantry will counterbalance great superiority unless they are commanded by fools. He has paid the penalty, but doubtless it was better to have fought and lost than not to have fought at all." No. Beatty gets the first part of it right. Gallantry and dash did not counteract the hard reality of technological advancement. Beatty was right about that. Now, where he was wrong is better to have fought and lost than not to have fought at all. Knowing that he was technologically overmatched, Craddock should have withdrawn the fleet. Whether a single machine gun can destroy a company of attackers in trench warfare, or the simple rule that the ship with the longer gun range will win. Technology had outstripped the tactics and even the mindset of the commanders in World War I. And it is also one of those lessons I wonder if we have learned every time I see one of our own magnificent aircraft carriers today. Aircraft carriers were the premier naval weapons in World War II, a war fought over 70 years ago, and they had supplanted the World War I era battleship. Of the four super battleships deployed in World War II by the Germans and Japanese, the Bismarck, the Tirpitz, the Musashi, and the Grand Yamato, all were partially or entirely sunk by air power. Today, the U.S. boasts of the impressive Gerald R. Ford, the U.S. Navy's newest and most advanced aircraft carrier. The Gerald R. Ford can do 30 knots, or about 35 miles per hour. Yet, here's the problem. A smart missile, however, can travel at Mach 10, or approximately 7,600 miles per hour. I have included British, French, and German accounts of the war, but you have noticed I left out Americans. I wanted to finish with a certain Lieutenant Ralph Waldo Tippett. He was my great-uncle and my father's namesake. He was first wounded in May 1918 and then later returned to combat. And on September 12, 1918, while advancing to locate a machine gun nest in the Saint-Mihiel sector, he was instantly killed by shrapnel. The American Army was preparing for the Meuse-Argonne Offensive, which involved up to 1.2 million American troops, when he died. His name is still listed in the memorial chapel at his and my alma mater of Lawrence University. He would have been 27 on his death. Adds Keegan, it is true that the Great War, by comparison with that of 1939 through 45, did little material damage, yet it damaged civilization, the rational and liberal civilization of the European Enlightenment, permanently for the worst, and, through the damage done, world civilization also. Pre-war Europe, imperial though it was in its relations with most of the world beyond the continent, offered respect to the principles of constitutionalism, the rule of law, and representative government. Post-war Europe rapidly relinquished confidence in such principles. In Barbara Tuchman's The Proud Tower, a work about pre-World War I Europe, this incomparable historian writes, "The old world had much that since has been lost, whatever may have been gained. Looking back on it from 1915, Emile Verhaeren, the Belgian socialist poet, dedicated his pages with emotion to the man I used to be." Thank you for listening to this latest of the Conservative Historian Podcast. Please check out all of them and really appreciate your tuning in. This is A.D. Tippett.